Perfect. All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Vanlo. I appreciate you having me up here to beautiful Minneapolis to speak, and thanks to y'all for coming out early this morning and finding us in the back of the basement. Felt like as I was coming here, I might have gone into the next county. I don't know. Took a while to get here from the front door. My name is Ryan Winston. I'm a PhD candidate at North Carolina State University, finishing up in less than a month, so I'm excited to be here and not staring at a computer screen writing my dissertation. And I'll be talking to you all. I've been given the task of talking to you all about an intro to stormwater, talk quantity and quality, kind of give a good introduction, hopefully, for the rest of the speakers. And at the end, I am going to put a little bit of data in related to my PhD work, which actually has been all in Ohio and not in North Carolina. So with that, we'll get running here. We'll start at the beginning, like as in second grade or third grade, maybe, the hydrologic cycle, right? We all know there's rainfall and runoff processes, and this is all in balance under a natural state, right? We have canopy interception from trees. We obviously have infiltration and abstraction that the soil gives us as part of its function. And when we build, we change that balance, right? So the hydrologic cycle is substantially different when we look at this type of condition, right? Our typical parking lot at a big box store, right? Our urban water cycle is nearly all runoff. It's conveyed into some sort of storm sewer network where we have a really hydraulically efficient way of moving that water to our streams and our surface water bodies. That has big impacts, as we'll talk about, on both the hydrology and the water quality of those systems. So urban hydrology, to go back to Hydrology 101, looks something like this. Before we develop in North Carolina, we have a forested condition, as we do in a lot of places across this country. And the hydrograph, the flow rate as a function of time, might look something like this. It's relatively shallow, not really peaky. There's less volume than there is when you have your big box store that you plop down on that plot of land, right? We have a hydrograph that has a higher peak. There's more runoff. The area under that curve is greater. The runoff arrives quicker. So there's a whole bunch of different timing, volume, rate, aspects of this change in hydrology that have big impacts, as we'll talk about in just a second. So the water budget. We got our happy forested condition. Okay, we've got our happy rabbit there sitting on the hill under the nice trees. It rains, so long-term hydrology here, think over the last century. What happens? Well, typically we have very little runoff, maybe 5% in the native pre-development case. And then the remaining portions of that that water budget are evapotranspiration and infiltration, either surface seepage or deep seepage. When we come through and we develop, we knock over all the trees, name the streets after the trees that we killed, and kill the rabbit as well. We end up with a lot of impervious surfaces, right? And these are hypothetical numbers. Obviously, this depends on the intensity of your development, how much impervious surface you put down on the ground. But you might increase the runoff fraction from 5% up to 55%, and then, of course, you're necessarily reducing the evapotranspirative and infiltrative portions of that water balance. Okay, so we just necessarily have more surface runoff that's occurring, and, of course, that has major impacts, as I mentioned earlier, on our surface water bodies. So what do we care about? Why do we care about stormwater management as a whole? What are the big drivers? Flooding, obviously. If you're in that house, you're not a happy camper, right? You've got water coming in through your door. I like to say it doesn't matter if you're Republican, Democrat, Independent, otherwise, you care about flooding, right? You care about whether you're flooded. So that's the first and foremost thing that we have cared about for years as stormwater managers is trying to mitigate the impacts of flooding. Then we have increased volume and rate of flow, right? We've got more water coming off of our urban watershed than we do under a pre-development condition. So that accelerates things like stream bank erosion. We have sloughing and loss of soil, major bank erosion, changes to the channel geometry, plan form, cross-section, etc. Then finally is increased pollutant loading. More volume results in additional mass of pollutants being pulled off of our urban watersheds when compared to our pre-development condition. So that impairs water quality. If we're using that for drinking water, we have to spend more money treating that water to get it to a drinkable state. Obviously, more polluted water has impacts on biota as well, aquatic biota as well. So what are other problems that occur in urban areas? Erosion is a big one. If you're in that house in the bottom right-hand corner of this picture, you may lose your master bedroom during the next hurricane that comes through, right? So that's obviously a big concern to that particular homeowner. Loss of real estate is a real problem. This is another example, kind of old school engineering techniques of gather the water and get it out as quickly as you can in that concrete trapezoidal swale, right? Engineers can design that cross-section really well. We can move the water and get it out of there. Well, what happens at the bottom of your watershed is what you see in the top right. The scale is a bit hard to see, but that's an 8-foot diameter corrugated metal pipe, folks. And that's about a 50-foot drop from where I took that picture. And there's a road that's been lost in that case. So that's what you pay. That's the price you pay there for kind of the old school engineering techniques of get the water out as quickly as you can. The other impact that urban watersheds have is to water quality, apart from the hydrologic aspects that I just talked about. One of our colleagues at NC State, Dan Line, did this study. This was a study looking at an undeveloped watershed, a forested watershed, and he compared that to a series of residential and commercial developments. And what he found was the undeveloped watershed had roughly one-third the loading, pollutant loading, for nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment as the commercial and residential developments did, right? We just have more runoff coming off of those developed sites. And so, again, roughly tripling the pollutant load when we come in and develop a particular watershed. So what pollutants are we concerned with? We're concerned with a number of them. It's going to depend on what part of the country you're from as to which ones might be your specific pollutants of concern. In North Carolina, nitrogen and phosphorus are big ones because we have had algal blooms. In our part of the country. So about 90% of nitrogen is atmospherically deposited in urban watersheds. So atmospheric deposition is the big source there. Phosphorus is typically associated with sediment. Most of it is associated with sediment. So again, erosion issues are a big source of phosphorus in urban areas. And then, of course, the soluble phosphorus typically is associated with lawn fertilizer. And this feeds our algal blooms, right? We don't have to go too far to the east of here to reach an area where algal blooms had a big impact last year, right? The city of Toledo and the algal blooms. That's a pretty amazing picture, I think, of the boat going through Lake Erie there. The algal blooms shutting down their water supply for, I think it was about 5 days last year, where they had to bring in all bottled water for 500,000 residents. So these types of issues can certainly have big and lasting impacts on our ability to live as humans. Other pollutants of concern: sediment is the number one pollutant in terms of miles of rivers impaired in North Carolina and in a lot of other states, just due to erosion. So we have a lot higher velocity. The water has a lot higher velocity coming off of a parking lot than it does off of a typical forested watershed. Heavy metals: there's a lot of different sources of heavy metals that are out there. Anything that's galvanized, so guardrails, copper flashing on roofs, brake pads, there's a half a pound of zinc in every tire. So you get a lot of different wear processes that occur that allow heavy metals to enter our stormwater runoff as well. Construction site runoff: Dr. McLaughlin will talk about this in a few talks. So a big source of sediment, if it's uncontrolled, construction site runoff has big impacts on watershed health as well. And then a few other pollutants: hydrocarbons, so leaky oil, grease type situations, and then bacteria from both pet waste as well as waste of wild animals, dumpsters, people dropping diapers in parking lots. You'd be amazed what you'd find if you hang around a Walmart parking lot, at Target, whatever. I'm not blaming Walmart, just any of them. So what types of impacts do these things have? I mentioned the algal blooms earlier. Bacteria is a big one on our coast in North Carolina. We have beach closures relatively frequently because we have direct discharge of stormwater onto our beaches. You can see one there from our urban areas along the coast. And, of course, those beach closures have substantial impacts dollars and cents-wise, right? In 2008, visitors to North Carolina, thank you for those of you who have visited North Carolina, spent $17.1 billion on tourism. And roughly one-fifth of that was in our coastal counties, directly tied to beaches. So if you have beach closures, obviously that impacts the bottom line of a lot of folks that depend on the beaches for their livelihood. And then finally, trash, not one you think about very often. We like to call these gross solids as engineers. That's what we term trash when it gets into the river. I guess because you can charge more for cleaning up gross solids than you can for cleaning up trash, right? But this is a substantial issue. We go back about 50 years, and we had enough trash in rivers that they were catching on fire, right? So we've done some things that are good. We don't have rivers catching on fire anymore, so that's a bonus, right? We've solved some problems, I like to think. But there are legitimate total maximum daily loads out there, legitimate regulations out there to limit the massive trash that goes into rivers, specifically out in California. All right, so what can we do to sort of ameliorate all of these issues, all of these problems? We can bring in what we like to call the stormwater control measure, or the old school term was BMP. Stormwater control measure is sort of the term that's evolved for urban type of issues. And so there's three things we're trying to combat. The first is flooding. Our old school, as Dr. Ivanlo mentioned earlier, our old school devices, ponds, large-scale practices were really aimed at the flooding aspects of stormwater management. The newer school, low-impact development type practices like bioretention and permeable pavement are designed to retain runoff and infiltrate and evapotranspire, so we're trying to get back to mimicking our pre-development condition, pre-development hydrology. And then also, the LID practices provide a lot in the way of filtration, physicochemical reactions to actually treat the pollutant load, so improving the water quality is another goal of these types of practices. I want to mention, I think there's going to be a couple of talks on this. There's a big push in a lot of regions for soil preservation and restoration as a stormwater BMP, and that's where I think y'all can really help us as engineers. I like to think I know a lot of things about soil, but I'm not a soil scientist. And so, you know, certainly healthy soils help to reduce runoff, and so in this case, this is King County, this is Seattle, Washington area. They now require any disturbed soils on construction sites to be basically ameliorated or improved through tilling, incorporation of compost, and also 4 inches of topsoil has to be placed on top of that soil before the site gets their certificate of occupancy and the person can come in and start their business. So I think this is a key point that a lot of folks are going to talk about later in the session, and so I wanted to intro that quickly. So traditional stormwater controls, I think y'all are probably familiar with them. Dry ponds and wet ponds are all over the place. We have literally thousands of wet ponds in North Carolina alone. Their focus is on flooding, so mitigating, say, the peak flow from a 10-year or a 50-year type storm event, so a storm that would occur 1 in 10 or 1 in 50 years on average statistically. And so what they look like are large holes in the ground. They either hold water or they don't. The ones that hold water are wet ponds. Okay, so these are pictures of typical wet ponds. Some of them can be quite nice looking. Others of them can be quite terrible. So this one's from North Carolina. I'll pick on us. Engineers like to draw things that are rectangular, right? It's easy to calculate the volume that's stored. So this is like the perfect engineered pond. But engineers aren't always good at the aesthetic side of things. So not the prettiest thing you've ever seen. Not going to increase the value of the real estate that's adjacent to that. Dry ponds are their cousin. These are ponds that don't hold water typically, but fill during a storm event and then slowly release that water back out into the stream after the event is over. They look pretty ugly in general. They're giant holes in the ground, essentially, that are grassed typically. This is the ugliest one I've ever seen in person, and it's like the best graffiti I've ever seen as well. I think the most appropriate graffiti, because that really is a holy terror. That is a dry pond. It's in Texas. This is courtesy of Dr. Barrett. I really appreciate him passing this along. But they can be quite ugly. And so these large-scale practices really are just aimed at peak mitigation. They do have some water quality benefits, some ancillary water quality benefits, but that's not the main design idea for these systems. Kind of a newer school approach to large-scale stormwater management or stormwater wetlands. So these can be used for peak flow mitigation, for knocking that post-development peak down. But they also incorporate, obviously, wetland soils and wetland vegetation. So we do, with these, actually aim at additional pollutant removal, nitrogen and phosphorus sediment-type benefits, heavy metals as well, when we install these systems. So these are kind of the newer school, more green, large-scale watershed, you know, treating 30 or 40 acres type of situation that are used quite frequently now in North Carolina. All right, so to move on to low-impact development, what we've been talking about with these larger-scale devices is really just knocking the peak flow off of the hydrograph. So it's that, let's see if I've got a pointer here. Here we go. So this is your typical wet pond, is this kind of orange color here. You're just knocking the peak off, but you have the same amount of volume leaving over time. And so that volume still has a lot of erosive impacts because typically the rate at which the water is delivered from that pond is still above minimum erosion rates for a stream. So with low impact development practices like bioretention, rainwater harvesting, permeable pavement, green roofs, what we're trying to do as we apply these on a watershed scale is actually mimic the entire hydrograph. So rate, volume, as well as timing. Okay, and that's a really challenging thing to do, but that's what we're attempting to do with these practices. So Most of these practices are infiltration-based. We're aiming to infiltrate water into the underlying soil, which we term exfiltration. We typically have a soil or specialized soil media, depending on the practice, and there's typically vegetation, except for permeable pavement. And our focus is on the first flush, so roughly the first 3/4 to 1 inch of rainfall, as opposed to potentially a 5 or 10 inch rain event with a wet pond or dry pond. Again, we're aiming at flooding control with those systems. So what are some of the typical LID practices? Well, vegetated swales are one that's out there. These are along every roadway, right? We call them drainage ditches typically, but you can really engineer these to be quite specific for pollutant removal treatment. So you can have engineered soil media in them with under drains. You can do step pool conveyance type systems. You can have wetland swales. So there's a bunch of different ways. You can put check dams in them. There's a bunch of different ways to improve their water quality performance that are really being studied heavily in this portion of the research literature. Rainwater harvesting is the simplest of BMPs, I think. It's been around for 2,000-3,000 years, right? The Romans did it. So we're capturing water off of a rooftop or a roadway, a parking lot, whatever it might be, and using it for beneficial use on a site, irrigation, toilet flushing, etc. Street trees, this is a big one, I think, a big up-and-coming area, using street trees for stormwater management. So we've done a study looking actually at silva cells, which have been used, I know, here in Minneapolis. Basically, they allow an uncompacted soil volume underneath a sidewalk, and the tree and that uncompacted soil volume, if you route water through it, can serve as a filter, right? And so not only does it filter for pollutants, this is an example of some of the data that we collected. The blue is your inflow hydrograph coming off of your small urban catchment. The red is your outflow hydrograph. So you can see there's less volume leaving by about 30%. The peak flow has been mitigated by half. So this is an example of very small-scale type LID practice that can impact at a small catchment level, a sub-block type level, the hydrology and water quality of an urban area. Okay, bioretention cells, these are probably the standard bearer for LID. This is the most commonly used practice. It's a media filter that's planted, so they can look much like a vegetated garden type area, but they have a specialized soil media that's placed in that bioretention cell. It's typically about 90% sand with clay and silt for pollutant removal, typically also in there, and some organic matter to allow for the plants to grow. You can see the typical cross section there on the left. So what we're doing is the water comes in, there's 9 to 12 inches of ponding on top of the soil media typically. The water filters through that specialized soil media and accesses an under drain. In this case, what we like to use is, you can see there's an upturned elbow in that under drain, right here, if I can get the cursor, here we are, right here. There's an upturned elbow in the under drain. So what that does is it forces internal ponding within the media. And so if you have underlying soils that are relatively clayey, what that allows is slow drawdown of that water, basically infiltration into the underlying soils, again, what we term exfiltration. That slow infiltration inter-event, right? So between storm events, you're actually getting a benefit from this system because you're infiltrating water into the native soil. And we'll talk about how that affects hydrology in just a second. So how these systems should work? After it rains, of course, there should be water ponded on the surface. If there's not, you have a substantial problem of some sort. 4 hours later, that water should have drawn down substantially. And then after 12 hours, you should see no water on the surface. So again, we have a relatively sandy soil that has a relatively high hydraulic conductivity, typically 2 to 4 inches per hour, that allows the water to move through. And again, that soil is acting as your filter. And at NC State, we like to say we're serious about bioretention. Does anyone know what famous painting we're imitating there? So yeah, this is our American Gothic. Our extension agents were really good about working with us, especially the one on the left who's imitating the woman. So we have a good time. We like to have a good time. So, all right. So permeable pavement is the last one I'm going to talk about. This typically is a some sort of permeable pavement surface. So it can be asphalt, it can be concrete, it can be interlocking concrete pavers, but it in some way has porosity inherent to the cross section, such that the water can move through the pavement surface and access an aggregate reservoir layer beneath the pavement. The aggregate has two purposes. One, of course, is structure, so it holds up the weight of vehicles that are driving over the permeable pavement. The other is hydrologic. The aggregate typically has about 40% porosity, so you can store a lot of water in there. And if you design the cross section correctly, you can infiltrate a lot of water into your native soils beneath these systems. So I promised I'd talk a little bit about my PhD. So these are the 4 permeable pavement monitoring sites that we had up in northern Ohio. So I was back and forth to Cleveland about every 2 weeks for the last 3 years. checking on these four sites, and we also looked at three bioretention cells. I'm not going to talk specifically about any of them, but I am going to talk about some modeling that we did looking at how these systems perform as far as volume reduction, so how much water we can expect to either evapotranspire or exfiltrate into the native soils, how they function for volume reduction over the long term. So what we did was we collected a bunch of field data on these systems and calibrated and validated a model called DrainMod, which is an ag drainage model that was developed at NC State. You can see there's a lot of similarities between bioretention with parallel drains and a typical parallel tile drained ag field, as well as surface storage, etc. And you can see calibration here. This is the storms that were observed are the symbols, and then the modeled are the lines. So you can see really good agreement between the modeled and measured. I'm not going to talk about that ad nauseum, but what has a big impact on performance of these systems are the underlying soils, okay? So the KSAT of the underlying soil has a huge impact. So at the bottom there, we have half inch per hour, 0.2, 0.05, and 0.02, so we're basically in B, C, and D hydrotic soil groups. And you can see the exfiltration and ET are the top two portions of each of those bars. So you can see there's about a 50% difference in long-term volume reduction from a half inch per hour underlying soil infiltration rate down to a heavy clay, a 0.02 inch per hour infiltration rate. Similar results for permeable pavement, substantial differences in volume reduction. So you want to site these systems over a sandier soil rather than a clayier soil. Internal water storage, this idea of an upturned elbow, also has a huge impact. Those are the two biggest impacts on long-term hydrology. So those are the two pieces that we really got out of our modeling. And I'm going to finish with, I'm going to skip through some of these slides because I'm short on time here. I'm going to finish with construction techniques. Avoiding soil compaction during construction is a huge issue because we are trying to infiltrate water. Obviously, compacted soil transmits water at a much lower rate than an uncompacted type of soil. So minimizing the movement of vehicles on and off of your construction site is key. We like to rip the subsoil, so we actually grab, in this case, a steel bar with the excavator bucket and drag it through the soil on 2-foot centers. You can see that there. So we're breaking up the soil compaction that's imparted by our big yellow machines that we've been working with as we build our permeable pavement or our bioretention cell. Other things that you can do, as opposed to smearing with the bucket, as you can see here, kind of scooping the soil, actually raking it with the teeth of the bucket as you take the last bite of the soil really substantially impacts the compaction. So this is cone index measured with a cone penetrometer. The scoop method has higher compaction at every soil depth at this particular bioretention cell that we were building than the rake method. So you're just breaking up any compaction as you drag the teeth of the excavator bucket through the underlying soil. So that's going to have substantial impacts on your hydrology as well. So excavating in dry conditions as well, not digging when the soil is wet. Backing out equipment using tracked vehicles and using the teeth of the bucket for that last bite of the soil really helps as well for construction of these systems. And with that, I am done. We are the Wolf Pack, so I'll say go Wolf Pack. And I think I have a few minutes, Dr. Vanlo, for questions, if there are any, on kind of an introduction to stormwater. I'm willing to take any.
It's a huge commitment to be able to break up soil for a foot and a half down. So is that, that's actually, for flushing, that's a requirement?
Yeah, it is. So I think they actually go through in subsoil in a lot of cases, their construction sites. They have to till compost to a 12-inch depth, which I think in some cases may be more depth than you actually need to see substantial soil improvement. And they have to bring in 4 inches of topsoil on top of all of that. So that's obviously a substantial cost as well to the developer, but it helps you have a really good soil cross-section to start with as opposed to a B horizon soil where you've scraped off all the topsoil and there's nothing to grow vegetation. So, yeah.
One more quick question.
Yep. That's a good question. Why did I choose Ohio for my experiment? Basically because it was where the money was. So we were able to get a subcontract up there to do a lot of monitoring and modeling. And so it was a big NOAA-funded project that was located around Cleveland and Sandusky area. And so we were kind of hired on as a subcontractor, and the rest is history.
Thank you.
Yep. So.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.